Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm one of the development fellows here at the college, and it's a pleasure today to speak to Professor Paul Little. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Good to have a chat with you today. And Paul, we're having a chat today about respiratory tract infections, which I think is an interest area of yours.
It certainly is. I've been researching in this area for about 30 years. Goodness knows, that feels like a very long time, but it's passed in a flash.
You've had an amazing research career, Paul, and I think if I'm right, you've won Research Paper of the Year 3 times.
Yes, that's quite correct.
And some really impactful research, which we'll touch on today. But how did you get into this research? I mean, it's obviously an important area for GPs.
I was given the opportunity to go and do a voluntary project in Nepal looking at deafness and ear disease. And it was very striking there that there was lots of suppurative infection, chronic infection, and people didn't have access to antibiotics. So I came back from that to my GP training, where there were sort of masses of antibiotics available, and the evidence for their use seemed to be not great even then. And so this huge contrast in behaviour of GPs and patients, because there was high expectation for antibiotics in a UK setting, prompted me to be interested and to start researching.
That's great, Paul. And obviously, it's such a common presentation in primary care. We give it that broad category of RTIs, respiratory tract infections. So I guess we could talk a little bit about what do we mean and how common they are.
In practice, most people know what we mean, sort of sore throat, cough, coryza, flu, sinusitis, and so forth. But if you want to be a little bit more precise, because obviously some of those symptoms can be caused by other things, for example, allergy. So normally we say something like two or more of those symptoms, sore throat, coryza, cough, flu, sinus, etc., usually with some systemic symptoms like myalgia and fever, or at least 2 days. And then you're pretty sure that's likely to be an RTI, because we deal in syndromes. We don't do swabs on everybody. It's a syndromic definition.
Yeah, absolutely. And what does that mean for us as a patient? How many colds, flu, coughs, etc. might we get in a year?
For patients living in the community, if you like, most adults will get a few infections a year, something between 2 and 4, and even more common in children. And obviously, we don't see most of those, but we see around 300 folk a year per 1,000 registered, half of whom will get antibiotics on average still. But I mean, it's a huge problem to society as well, because 30% of workdays lost are due to RTIs. It always has been one of the biggest causes of sickness absence.
And the vast majority, as you mentioned, probably don't benefit from antibiotics, most likely viral infections.
Yeah, that's right. There's a huge range of viruses circulating in the winter. Flu, rhinovirus, RSV, SARS-CoV-2 now is actually around most of the time. So there's any number of viruses that will get you, if you like, mostly from autumn. It starts when the kids go back to school and viruses start circulating again, but worse from probably December through February, really, the winter pressure period.
And we think it's worse in the winter because we're more inside with other family members. We're kind of congregating together, I guess, with the seasonality.
That's one of the factors, absolutely. The other interesting thing, which was researched by the Common Cold Unit, was that they looked at the fact that if you're in colder environments, viruses last a bit longer. They last a bit longer on surfaces. And also, if you are cold, you get a reflex reduction in the temperature in your nasopharynx, and viruses like that. So both in the environment and in your immune response, viruses have a real advantage in the winter. Plus, as you say, you know, we're mingling much more together. We're indoors much more. Social distancing is a real issue and always has been, and COVID actually brought that home very strongly, I think.
Absolutely. I think it's important to stress the natural history of respiratory tract infections, often a lot longer than we might or the general population think.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly the ones we see. And if you think about the 4 common presentations, otitis, sore throat, sinusitis, and bronchitis, most of the folk we see for those respectively will be 1 to 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, and 10 days prior to seeing us. And then after seeing us, you're talking about 3 to 5 days, 5, 7, and 10 days. You need some kind of way of getting a handle on that you can share with patients. So I think of half a week, 2 weeks, and 3 weeks, roughly, just so that people will know, particularly for sinusitis and bronchitis. These are really long-lasting illnesses. Those are the averages. So 50% of people will have an illness lasting longer than, say, 20 days for chest infections. And people just have no idea that they've had it a week or 10 days and they need antibiotics. That's roughly when most people come and see us. They've had it a week to 10 days for their chest infection. They think this is going on too long. And, you know, the main thing is advise them about the natural history of their illness so they can expect it to go on for another 10 days, irrespective of antibiotics, and maybe longer than that. So having that natural history information at your fingertips is really quite useful. I've given you ballparks, but they're not far out.
Yeah, and I think that's really useful. We probably come on to signposting and reinforcement. We're using text messaging in practice as well, which can be very helpful for giving people this information. And a lot of practices now have moved to triage, doctor first sort of model, where we would sort of triage the initial information and signpost. And there's obviously pharmacy first schemes, self-management, etc. So how we might assess that as a GP, which patients do we really need to see, do you think?
Basically, if it's uncomplicated illness, which the vast majority of people have, complication rate is really low. So, you know, of the order of 1 in 200, something like that, significant complications, whether it's quinsy or a sort of major pneumonia. So the main thing you need to always be aware of are the red flags. So is the skin really cold or a strange colour or a funny rash? Is the patient confused or drowsy? Significant shortness of breath. I mean, most people with a respiratory infection will have some shortness of breath, but, you know, an adult respiratory rate of greater than 25, something like that. Signs of meningitis, severe headache, neck stiffness, those sort of things. For sore throat, difficulty swallowing, drooling, or if they've had a temperature that's just been going on more than 38 for more than 5 days. So standard stuff about slightly more severe illness or sepsis. Those are the really key things, because even if it's complicated illness, the chances are you're going to end up seeing the patient. But if it's severe complications, particularly sepsis, you want to be onto that early.
Absolutely. And I think with the triage systems, and a lot of areas might in the winter have respiratory hubs. So that's kind of extra surge capacity, yeah, which is in primary care. We obviously have the pharmacy first schemes as well, so a lot of practice will be sort of diverging to that. I don't know if there's any sort of evidence on that. My slight worry is we'll probably end up with more people getting antibiotics for these schemes, but obviously it does help with our workload a little bit potentially.
It is a real worry. So I think pharmacy first, what we know about it so far, because they prescribe according to patient group directions. Actually, for example, for sore throat, you only get prescribed if you've got a positive streptococcal antigen test. So automatically that will reduce the number of antibiotic prescriptions. So where there's a patient group direction that it's very well circumscribed like that, I think there's no great danger. I think the danger is if it becomes easier for pharmacists to prescribe, and actually all pharmacists coming out of their training now are going to be able to prescribe according to clinical judgment. And my real worry is in that situation, will pharmacists end up prescribing more antibiotics because of patient pressure and patients knowing they can get antibiotics for the pharmacist? So I think we are in significant danger and that you just need to monitor that. But so far, I would say actually there's good evidence from what we know that pharmacists manage these conditions well.
That's really good to hear. Thank you, Paul. Probably that we might end up seeing, you know, younger patients and those older ones with comorbidities. And it might be those patients that with low risk, we either advise pharmacy self-management, et cetera, from our triage systems. Right. Just about the sort of evidence, obviously, a lot of this is predicated on trying to reduce that inappropriate antibiotic prescribing. We've seen a lot of those campaigns about use antibiotics wisely. We've got the target toolkit on the RCGP website. Do we know if there's been any impact on antibiotic use in the UK and or other countries?
The evidence is actually pretty modest in the UK in terms of our success in reducing antibiotic prescribing significantly. But I think there's ongoing pressure. So are you an optimist or a pessimist? I'm an optimist. So I think with the caveat that we don't get the problem in pharmacies where pharmacists are using clinical discretion like GPs often do, perhaps not appropriately. But we haven't cracked it yet. And I think we need ongoing attention to this. The fact is, it's very easy if somebody comes in and you want a quick consultation, it is actually quite easy to give an antibiotic prescription and the patient will go out of the door. I think that's not great practice because actually we know most folk won't need it and you encourage a cycle of beliefs and behaviour. So actually we make ourselves busy by using infections as a quick consultation. So I think it needs ongoing attention and awareness that actually antibiotic resistance is probably, next to obesity, one of the biggest public health threats of our time. It really is a big threat.
Absolutely agree. And I think potentially, you know, they might see it as a quick win, but then it'd be a rod for your own back. So there's a lot we can do as individuals, but also obviously within our practices, you know, to look at our prescribing rates, but also think about, you know, actually just going through the patient, their ideas, concerns, expectations, saying this is viral. Do you understand what viral is? I found this a lot easier during the pandemic because there was a lot of public health messaging about what viruses were. I kind of feel we've slightly regressed a little bit, but obviously it's using that as a teachable moment, I think, to try and say, look, there's a lot you can do for yourself without the need for antibiotics.
Absolutely. So some people respond to the virus message well, others not so well. So I do sometimes talk about that. Often, though, what you find is that us as docs tend to misascribe the worry people have about their symptoms and or something horrible happening. And if you can unearth that and say, was there anything particularly you were worried about, the whole pressure for a doctor to prescribe, I think, becomes less. So that's one of the key things. It's basic communication skills about unearthing people's concerns and expectations and having a brief chat about that. It doesn't take long, but well worth it. Because we do know if you prescribe an antibiotic, there's a 40% increase in reconsultations for the next episode compared with not prescribing or delayed prescribing. So really is a big effect. And the practices that can manage to reduce their prescribing make themselves less busy. So it is this business of we make a rod for our own backs if we prescribe for more patients than we need to.
So I think a top tip there, look at your own prescribing. Also think about chatting with colleagues at practice meetings or other things. And I think a lot of the local pharmacy teams now, we do have that sort of benchmark data on prescribing at a practice level that you can have a look at. And GPs are often interested in how I compare to my colleagues in the local area. So I think that kind of data is available. Think about antibiotics. What are the sort of rough number needed to treat, number needed to harm? So I think that's always an important discussion with patients as well about who would benefit, what's the harms, who were going to prescribe.
So first thing to think about is the natural history. We've already talked about having a good idea of what the natural history of the particular presentation you're dealing with. But for each of those, for our studies over the years, you're talking about benefit of a day or less than a day. So really minimal benefit. And then if you look at the wider evidence, not just our studies, so the Cochrane, you're talking about numbers needed to treat. And this isn't just primary care studies, obviously. Numbers to treat of the order of 20 for pain, day 3 for otitis, 18 for sore throat, day 7, sinusitis 14 at day 7, and bronchitis around sort of 11 at day 7. So in the short to medium term, there really isn't much evidence for benefit. You have to treat quite a few patients for one to benefit. Harms are relatively uncommon. So we found, for example, in our big chest infection randomized placebo-controlled study with sort of 2,000 plus patients, that in fact the supposed side effects of antibiotics, so diarrhea and skin rash and so forth, they occurred almost as commonly in the placebo group, because that's just the illness. But you are talking about a number needs to harm of probably between 15 and 20, something like that. So the number needs to benefit and the number needs to harm are similar-ish. So you're not gaining much if it's uncomplicated illness. Complicated illness, you don't want to mess around. So if you think it's pneumonia, then you treat. If you think it's an incipient quinsy, you treat, and so forth.
So it's really about, as you said, that symptom iceberg, that almost pyramid we talk through in training. So it's kind of severe patients with severe signs and symptoms that we would treat, and everyone else we would safety net. And if people were very keen, we could really touch on that delayed prescribing as well as an option.
I think it is an option. The evidence suggests that on balance, you get pretty good reductions in antibiotic use if you use delayed prescribing. So going from 50% or more down to 20 to 30%, which actually would make a huge difference if we all did that. But if you are using delayed prescription, you do have to make sure that you use it, if you like, as we did in the trial. So you wouldn't want somebody to use their delayed prescription other than in the context of the normal natural history. So you have to give the natural history information, say you really don't need this now, but if things should get dramatically worse over the next day or so, or few days, or it's going on for much, much longer than the natural history, then consider using it. But basically, the message is you don't need these at the moment, and this is just a backup. And I would use it where you were feeling a little bit unsure and you wanted them to have rapid access to a prescription, because actually, we know that's the case, that if it's done properly, you don't get great harms and patients actually do slightly benefit. So I think you could use it, but for most people, if you're happy clinically that they don't need an antibiotic, you don't need to use a delayed prescription.
Absolutely. I think that's a key thing. It's explaining the natural history and providing some written information. So we've touched a bit about most practices using text messaging. So I think it's really useful. You can write people an individualized plan. It's recorded in their notes and they'll have access to that as well about when to utilize the antibiotic, and you can send links, etc. I find that really useful, and for safety netting as well. And then just to have a think about potential red flags, when to reconsider the diagnosis. So obviously we're really touching on infection here, but I guess the other thing is to think about if people are repeat attending, there's other symptoms, smokers, etc., when we might think about chest x-rays, other tests like sputum test.
I think unless somebody has known chronic lung disease, I really wouldn't bother with a sputum test. And if somebody's got chronic airways disease and you've empirically treated with them antibiotics and they come back, I think probably that would be the time to do a sputum test. Chest x-ray, the main worry is people with lung cancer. if you're suspicious with somebody, they're reconsulting and they've had a history of smoking particularly, then I would have a lower threshold for chest x-ray. But we don't want to be x-raying most people with uncomplicated illness because you're just sort of getting unnecessary x-rays. So I'd be conservative, but I'd have an index of suspicion, particularly with smokers, for chests.
And then thinking about some novel approaches. So there's been some research about point of care CRP testing. And I think, Paul, you might have done some of that research. So can you maybe overview that and whether we might use that in practice in the future?
Yes, we did a big study with some very brief training for GPs to use point of care testing. This was CRP for chest infections and had a fantastic effect over the first winter season. And then we followed up people after that for the next season and it had absolutely no effect. And that was despite paying GPs for the kit and the samples and all the rest of it. So what I found for me is that I ended up not using CRP. It was extra time. You needed extra staff time. You needed to wait until the result and deal with it. So I think for me, CRP isn't that useful, but some people do find it useful and it certainly can help you decide if you're sort of on the margins, you think they might have a low-grade pneumonia, you're really not sure. And I think it can help for some people if you want to persuade them not to use an antibiotic. So you're pretty convinced that clinically they're okay, but there's a lot of pressure coming from them. So I think tests can help there sometimes too. But overall, what we showed was that GPs didn't go on using them routinely anyway.
And then your more recent research, which I think won research paper of the year from last year into this year. So that was around nasal sprays. Can you talk us through a little bit about that?
Probably one of the most useful bits of research we've ever done. It was an enormous trial, sort of nearly 14,000 people. And there were two groups who had spray. So one was Vicks First Defense, which is useful. It's an antiviral spray. So it's sort of polymer to mop up viruses, but also it reduces the pH in the nasopharynx, which the viruses don't like. So we had Vicks, we had isotonic saline, which it turns out is also quite a powerful antiviral. And the way that works is because the chloride in the saline gets taken up by the cells, converted to a natural hypochlorite acid, which inhibits viral replication. And what we found in that study was that the impact of Vicks First Defense or isotonic saline was identical. And because saline had slightly lower side effects, Vicks caused headache in a few more people, saline is the optimal choice. And what we found was basically 20% reduction in illness days over 6 months, 20% reduction in severity, a 30% reduction in antibiotic use, and some other surprising benefits, fewer falls as well. So a no-brainer, really. This is cheap stuff. Anybody can get it from the chemist. And the key thing is use it at the first sign of any illness, or the first tickle in the nose or slight cough, because it's really early in the illness where the viral load is high and you want to hit the viral load. And that's what these sprays are doing. So I think if this was widely used, particularly by people who are at higher risk from infection, sort of standard folk who come and get their flu jabs every year, I think it could make a really meaningful difference. So I think even though there's a lot more research that needs doing on these sprays, I think we know that even with modest adherence, which is what we found in our trial, they have a pretty useful effect and pretty much anyone can afford to use them.
I think that's a really positive message for us in primary care, for saying you don't need antibiotics, but actually use these nasal sprays. They do work, and encouraging people to use them widely, I think, will be really helpful. That's something we could do in our own practice or when we're seeing patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly think of the higher risk, more frail individuals who will be more at risk from infections. Yeah, I mean, the contrast with antibiotics is stark. We haven't shown that antibiotics make that kind of difference to illness, but go and get some saline from the chemist and it will. It'll help you.
Yeah, I mean, you touched also about flu jabs. So obviously we've got this high risk patients there. We encourage those people to have their influenza jabs, maybe seen a bit of a reduction in that. So I think that is important to encourage at risk groups to have their vaccinations.
Absolutely. So in our trial, the effect that we showed was over and above what was a highly vaccinated population. So vaccination is great. It's the primary thing, but the sprays use really had an additional effect. The other thing that was worth talking about with your patients, we developed a website to help people manage stress and physical activity, freestanding website, but there's lots of information out there how people can manage stress, because we know that stress increases your likelihood of getting an infection, having a prolonged infection, and that people who can maintain their physical activity are likely to have less impact in terms of getting an infection and also how long it is. And what we showed was actually that using this website to support stress management and physical activity, there was 5% reduction in the incidence of infections in that group. So small effect, but it was a freestanding website. So I think it's worth thinking about that when you see patients. Stress is relevant, physical activity is relevant.
And what about hand washing, which we haven't really touched on, but obviously we had all the messaging in the pandemic counts when you're doing that.
That is such a simple thing. One of our biggest trials was on using a website called Germ Defense, which is still there, basically teaching people why they should wash their hands and how to wash their hands. And anybody can use that. And that study, we showed a 15% reduction in infection just for a freestanding website. And I suspect people aren't washing their hands anymore now that COVID has passed, but it really does make a difference. So again, particularly for the high-risk individuals, just reinforce, please wash your hands, particularly as you're coming in from outside, because you'll have got virus outside. So you want to get rid of virus. Because not only did people who were randomized to get the advice, if you like, from this website, they had a reduction in illness. There was a reduction in illness in the family, plus a reduction in GI illness. So it's a no-brainer. It's simple. We can all do it, but we've all probably stopped doing it since COVID. So it's well worth thinking about and advising still.
Definitely for us as practitioners to do that in our own practice, encourage patients to do it and colleagues in our practice. To summarize the top tips for GPs and trainees into their practice, and where next for this research?
Well, in terms of top tips, sort of what we haven't touched on is we've shown in one of our trials that actually access to good information about natural history and what simple things that you can do, you know, simple over-the-counter remedies. And I think the Target Toolkit is a really useful resource for practices. Lovely leaflets you can give to patients so you don't have to go through all of the safety netting, but saying, you know, these are really important things to look out for. I think there's enough evidence that practice level audit and feedback can help. It's a simple thing to do. It's one of the things you can do. And I think it's one of the things to just keep people's eye on the issue of antibiotic use and antibiotic resistance. I think the evidence we have about hand washing and the use of simple nasal sprays is always worth remembering. I don't think there's going to be a more definitive trial of nasal sprays or of hand washing. So that evidence is really robust. So advising hand washing, linking to the Germ Defense website is worth knowing that, and advising the use of sprays really important and might be worth highlighting. Actually, I don't think antibiotics are going to help you and you'll get all the disadvantages of antibiotics, but sprays really can help. So why not pop down the chemist? And then I would think about stress management and physical activity management when you're chatting with people who come with infections. So all of that, I think, is really useful just for everyday practice.
That's a really helpful summary. Thank you, Paul, because I think it's such an important area for us as GPs, particularly during these winter months that we're in at the moment. So really, thank you very much. And just where next for your research?
I think the big thing is, because we showed that there was a pretty good effect with the sprays, even though people didn't do quite what we wanted. So both in terms of managing the illness, I think we now know that, I didn't know at the time, the reason we found an effect is because saline's a natural antiviral. It's a really brilliant thing. It's a brilliant message to give people. But actually what we need to show is that when we give people that message and we deal with the other adherence issues, which we know they had, like how best to use the sprays in everyday life, all sorts of things we could do, I think we might well get a much bigger effect, and we need to show that. And the second thing I think we need to try and show is whether we can use sprays to prevent illness. Because people didn't do what we wanted quite in our spray study, we couldn't show that. But I think it's very likely if these sprays can reduce viral load and reduce illness duration and severity, they should work as preventers as well. So I think that we need to show that, because again, that could make a huge difference. So I think those are the key things for me anyway, to concentrate over the next year or so. But there's a whole range of other stuff. So what is the place of point of care tests? How can we most helpfully do that and maintain that? What is the place in the community for pharmacists who are free to prescribe? How can we make sure that we don't increase the danger of antibiotic resistance? So there's a whole range of stuff that I'm still keen on trying to research, I guess.
That's great, Paul. Thank you. And I mean, thanks for all the work you've done in this area. I mean, anyone listening to this will just see your passion for this and also the practice-changing research you've done. So this is really hats off to you.
Well, you're most kind, Thomas. Thank you.
We discussed today, for example, the Target Toolkit and other resources. Please have a look at the RCGP website. We've got some really great resources on there for people to have a look at. There's websites that Paul mentioned as well, which can be really helpful. You can signpost patients to those. And obviously look at our other podcasts on e-learning as well. Thank you, Paul. It's a real pleasure. And thank you for listening to this RCGP podcast. Thank you and goodbye.